This is Division A of the Colorado Court of Appeals. This is a special session, and we are hearing oral argument today on a motion to, I'm going to just forget the title of the right, on the motion for an order providing further direction to the trial court in the remand proceedings in the case of People Against Robert Ray. Thank you very much for coming and accommodating this request, and I see the council are set up, and so without further ado, we'll begin. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Mr. Howard, Ms. Atkinson. My name is Gail Johnson, registration number 29703. I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellant, Robert Ray, along with my co-counsel, Elizabeth Hunt-White. I thought I would start by going through the eight items that the court identified it would like to have addressed today. The first question was, is there a transcript of the hearing that was held on the first day of jury selection, which was October 13th, 2006? There is a partial transcript, as we have notified the court. It's about 10 pages long, and we do ask the court to order the district court to supplement the record with that transcript that is now available. With respect to the other portion of proceedings held on that day related to jury selection and the denial of the motion for change of venue, was apparently not recorded. There is no transcript available. We have set forth Mr. Ray's statement in our original CAR 10C statement of what those proceedings were. The government has no objection, and so we would ask this court also direct the district court to settle the record and accept our undisputed statement as to those proceedings.
Why the remainder of the hearing was not recorded?
I don't believe it is clear why, Your Honor, and I'm sure the court will have many questions like that today that simply are ambiguous from the existing record. Moving to the court's second question, should the district court be ordered to clarify whether it accepts defendant's account of the unrecorded bench conferences that occurred before Mr. Martin's testimony on October 20th, 2006? Yes, and to be clear, the state had no objection to our statement as to the content of the unrecorded bench conference. That's in their response, page 2. There was a mistake and error. We had made a mistake in terms of what occurred on the record, and that was just our error. We accept that that's wrong, and that's been corrected. So the district court should be ordered to simply clarify that it now accepts and settles the undisputed statement of the content of what occurred during the unrecorded bench conference.
Why is it necessary to clarify when the court's order seems clear and says that confirms its standing practice and affirms its standing practice and adopts appellate counsel's recollection of the nature of the bench conference? And that seems like you're asking us to order the court to do that again, to say that differently somehow.
Your Honor, I believe the district court had a different response. There were many unrecorded bench conferences, and so generally the district court did accept our version of the content of the unrecorded bench conferences. And again, I apologize if this is our error that caused this. There's a bit of a red herring here because we made a mistake in our initial statement with respect to Mr. Martin and what happened surrounding that on the part that was recorded. And I think because of that, there's some ambiguity now in the district court's order. So we're simply asking for a clarification that with respect to the unrecorded bench conference, including the one relating to Mr. Martin's testimony, our undisputed statement is settled and now part of the record. With respect to the third items, and there's two parts, the first part is should the district court be ordered to supplement the record with its proposed comments to jurors regarding contact with court staff? Yes, this is something that the district court actually said back at the time of trial on the record that it would do, but it's that we don't find it in the record, and so we need that part of the record supplemented. In terms of the second part of the court's question, should the court be ordered to reconstruct for inclusion in the record all unrecorded instances of juror contact with court staff? Yes, and our position is this is an important issue that bears directly on Mr. Ray's federal and state constitutional rights to due process and a fair trial.
On that point, how this is going to be relevant in an appeal, because this statement of these events, this if it were to happen, would never have been placed before the district court to inform any particular ruling. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I think the record shows that there were a number of juror contacts, and it's ambiguous. And so, yes, the statement is not already in the record. But to be clear, I think one thing everyone in this courtroom can agree on is that this case is going to receive a lot of scrutiny for years to come in the state courts and potentially in federal courts if it goes that far. So our position generally is that it's important to have a complete and accurate record so that we can do our job as Mr. Ray's counsel now. And frankly, years have passed, that is true. But if we don't settle it now up front, that problem is only going to get worse as time goes on. I refer the court to this court's opinion in People versus McLaughlin, 166 P3rd 182, division of this court in 2007, ultimately reversed a conviction because the original reconstruction proceeding had frankly been unsuccessful. I think it's in everyone's interest to go back and have a complete record of these proceedings.
Given. I'm saying, in connection with these unrecorded bench conferences, have you made an effort to reconstruct them yourself?
Yes. With respect to all of the unrecorded bench conferences, we have addressed them and set forth our statement as to each one, identified by the date, volume, transcript, and where they occur, in our original CAR 10C statement. And the state does not object to our characterization of any of those. And the district court has already accepted those. I think the only issue on the unrecorded bench conferences that was still ambiguous was the one we discussed earlier, number two, with respect to surrounding Mr. Martin's testimony.
I guess what I'm focusing on is the propriety of using settling the record correcting the record to create essentially a record of something that was never recorded before. This seems to be the creation of additional evidence or additional findings or something like that, and it seems to be outside the usual scope of what we contemplate when we think about these kinds of proceedings.
Well, Your Honor, I understand the court's concern, but I do think that we have CAR 10C and 10E for a reason, and to some extent it does contemplate that on occasion things are omitted for the record for reasons we can't discern. Was it a court clerk? Was it a trial counsel error? We don't know sometimes. But even when there, I think 10E refers, even when something is omitted from the record by mistake or accident, it's appropriate for the district court to reconstruct it. And again, our position is going to be that reconstruction is going to be much more efficient and much more accurate if it happens now in 2011 and potentially early 2012 than if it goes another few years into the post-conviction proceedings or, again, potentially federal court.
Is there any indication that the trial court's comments that the trial court was going to give to the jurors but didn't was omitted by mistake or error?
So to be clear, my reading of the record is that the trial court had a written document it was referring to. And so it was a written document that the court uses as a guide to read to every juror in every criminal case, presumably. And what the district court said on the record in this case was, I will give you a copy of that so it's in the record, but it's simply not there. So that's the document we're trying to supplement the record with respect to that first half of number three. Moving on to number four, should the district court be ordered to supplement the record with the November 7th, 2006 minute order granting the prosecution's motion to photograph and remove trial exhibits? Again, I think this is an easy one for this court to resolve. The state has asked that the record be supplemented with that minute order as well. So I think the answer is yes, the court should be so ordered. On number five, again, I think this is an easy one. This is the McVeigh opinion that trial counsel clearly believed was attached to his motion regarding contacts and media coverage in this case. Again, the state does not object to the supplementation of the record with the McVeigh opinion that we've identified.
Why is it necessary to include that record when?
Very good question, and I'm happy to answer it. If you go on Westlaw and search on a McVeigh opinion, you'll find that there's a number of them because that case was so heavily litigated. There are multiple published McVeigh opinions. The citation is not in the current record. So whether we supplement the record with the document or whether we have the district court take judicial notice that the document that was attached is the citation we've provided, 918 F sup 1452, either one of those I think would be acceptable to us.
Counsel, one question I had, I guess, was about the minute order allowing for the withdrawal or removal of exhibits. I'm curious just why it's going to be relevant. Is there a contention that the exhibits have been altered and are now are no longer the same now they've been brought back?
Your Honor, I think we have a duty to investigate and ensure the integrity of the appellate record, which includes the trial exhibits. These were critical exhibits. These are scene diagrams, and they were used during the testimony of, I believe, multiple witnesses. So in order to read the witness testimony and understand it, one needs to be able to read it with those exhibits. And we thought it was important in this quasi-capital case to settle the record now to make sure that there's some integrity of the record and to investigate the propriety of those proceedings. The state's motion asking for permission for this and the order apparently occurred on the same day or within 24 hours. So it does not appear that there was an opportunity for the defendant to object, and that may be an issue on appeal.
One of the items you discussed was whether it would be necessary to clarify whether the court held a hearing on that. Do you have any opinion now, or what's your...
We're asking the district court be ordered to clarify that. There's no evidence in the record that a hearing was held, but certainly if one was, we need to investigate that. There was also no evidence to us that there was a minute order until the people finally filed their response and provided it to us, because we had asked for it and we hadn't received it. So sometimes these things come up, much like the transcript of the first day of jury selection. Until you ask for it, you don't get it. So if I could move on to number six, which has to do with whether the district court should be ordered to supplement the record with photographs showing the size of the trial courtroom. Again, I think this is easy for the court to resolve. The state had no objection, no amendment to our statement on this issue, and they specifically said they have no objection to supplementing the record with our Exhibit A, which are these photographs that show the size of the courtroom. I believe the district court simply made a mistake when the district court ruled and thought that the government was objecting when really they haven't.
Am I correct in understanding that part of your request, though, was that Judge Spears certify that the pictures are a fair and accurate representation of the courtroom?
We were looking for some sort of authentication procedure. It could be that Judge Spears certifies, as the court has suggested. It could be, perhaps, that the photographer authenticates it. It could be that the state stipulates that they're a fair and accurate representation. Any one of those procedures might be available to the district court, but I think it's helpful if they are not just supplemented into the record, but authenticated, yes.
And counsel, this too is a little different in that this is essentially the creation of new information or new evidence that was never has yet to be placed before the district court, you know, to inform some ruling, right?
Your Honor, the existing record strongly suggests that trial counsel for Mr. Ray had an intent to introduce these photographs. We can't tell, as appellate counsel reading the cold record, whether he did do that and it's simply not appearing in the record that we have, or whether he didn't do that.
Do you think the photographs are related?
Your Honor, there were multiple objections from the defense trial team as to the trial proceeding in the courtroom, which was an extraordinarily small courtroom, I believe unlike any other at the Arapahoe County District Court. And there were concerns about the jurors being seated so close to the prosecution table where conversations were happening among prosecutors and advisory witness, law enforcement witnesses. And there was some evidence in the record that a juror had responded visibly to some conversation that was going on the table. So it is a potential issue. Moving to number seven, I see my time is running down. I'll do the best I can.
Let me keep you up here a little longer. So,
thank you, Your Honor. Number seven is, should the district court be ordered to reconstruct the security measures that were in place during Mr. Ray's trial? Again, yes, this is a critically important issue that bears on Mr. Ray's federal and state constitutional rights to due process and a fair trial by an impartial jury. The state has asserted that they object to our statement under CAR 10C, but they have not specified which part they object to or what the nature of their objection is. It seems to me that this is a situation when the facts are disputed between the parties, a reconstruction evidentiary hearing is appropriate and should be ordered. And again, this is going to be a big issue, but this really is either going to be reconstructed now when memories are maybe not fresh, but not as stale as they're going to be later if it has to be reconstructed later. So we would ask the court to ensure that this is reconstructed now so that we can have a more efficient and accurate record of what exactly occurred. And again, the court knows this was an extraordinary case. There were snipers on the roof, and this was not your average criminal trial in the Arapahoe County District Court.
Johnson, similar to what the question that Judge Russell asked you about the photographs of the courtroom, this seems to be new evidence that wasn't in the trial, and it seems to be rather than reconstructing a record, it seems to be adding something to the record that wasn't there before. Why should we order that be done, and under what authority?
I think the court can look to the authority of CAR 10E, which again says that where information is missing due to mistake or accident, it can still be reconstructed as part of the direct appeal.
Do you have any indication that this information is missing due to mistake or accident?
I don't think there's a specific part of the record that I could direct the court to on to say yes, no. I'm not aware of anything in the record that would support that, but it certainly was an issue. There's a reference to documentation, but no documentation was put in.
Now, you alluded to the likelihood of information proceeding. Can you describe to me how that would happen in post-conviction proceedings? What would the steps be to determine the security measures or to gain evidence about this?
If this matter were delayed until the post-conviction.
Well, post-conviction counsel are independently investigating whether Mr. Ray's federal and state constitutional rights were violated at the trial. So they have been and will continue to conduct their own investigation and presumably seek an evidentiary hearing in the district court on their issues, one of which may be...
Could relate to this very event that you're talking about. Okay, and so I guess the answer to my question is that this could be evidenced, a record could be established through an evidentiary hearing, right? And that would be the way to do that in a post-conviction proceeding.
Presumably, yes. I don't want to speak on behalf of post-conviction counsel, and frankly, there's an inherent conflict of interest.
I don't mean to suggest that there is that possibility that it would happen that way. I'm trying to figure out, I guess, what's the difference between how we would go in the post-conviction proceeding as opposed to how we'd go if we did it here on direct appeal. What really is the advantage of doing it now? Is this going to avoid an evidentiary hearing, or will it trigger a similar evidentiary hearing?
I think it could avoid an evidentiary hearing, Your Honor, and I think it would make the evidentiary hearing that inevitably is going to be held more accurate because of the timeliness difference. Because this could happen next month or January as opposed to whenever the post-conviction proceedings get to it. And frankly, this case is gargantuan. There's a lot of different post-conviction issues. There will be extensive evidentiary hearings. I had a non-capital post-conviction case in Arapahoe County that lasted 4 years of evidentiary hearings spread out over time. So I think I'm speaking from experience when I say, in our opinion, doing it now, doing it right, before memories fade any further, would be the practical, common sense solution. And finally, if I could address the court's eighth question, should Mr. Ray be granted a reasonable time in which to locate sealed documents that were filed or intended to be filed in support of his motion to continue the trial? Our position, again, is yes. And here I would like to give the court a concrete sense of the task we are talking about here. There are apparently more than 80 boxes of documents of trial counsel's files that comprise files that are somewhat mixed up now between the capital case and the Lowry Park case, which we are here on today. So this is a time-consuming project, and the status procedurally right now is that the district court has given us an order saying it doesn't matter, appellate counsel, if you find these documents, because I'm not going to supplement the record with them anyway. So our position is that the district court should be ordered to give us time for us to search for these documents. They may exist in trial counsel's files, they may not, we don't know. But we didn't seem to make sense from an efficiency standpoint with state funds to have appellate counsel spend time going through 80 boxes if the district court's answer is going to be no, you can't supplement anyway.
Can you give me a sense of why, in your view, the district court is ruling that you cannot or that it would not accept those?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court stated that in its view it was outside the scope of this court's remand order. That appeared to be the basis of the district court's ruling on that issue.
What is the motion to continue?
this is a very important motion to continue trial that was denied. So essentially, Mr. Root, who was lead counsel for Mr. Ray at trial, came on the case, I believe, in April of 2006 and was forced to try it just 6 months later in October of 2006. It was a rather rapid time frame for a case with the implications that this one had.
Is it undisputed that these documents never were filed?
I don't believe that is undisputed, Your Honor. I think it's ambiguous. But if I may check with co-counsel, I may. And I'm not sure if the court wants to allow rebuttal. I see my time is up, and I've gone through all 8 questions. But if the court has any other questions, I'm happy to.
Now we're set to go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Catherine Adkisson, Deputy Solicitor General, appearing on behalf of the Attorney General's Office. With me are co-counsel Mr. John Howard, Chief Deputy from the Arapahoe DA's office, and Anton Sick and Emily Warren, also Chief Deputy DA's from that office. Although my office is ultimately going to be handling this appeal, we did not participate in any of the reconstruction hearings below. And Mr. Howard is here with the court's permission to explain to the court what transpired. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I have not done this before, so forgive me. I'm not sure of the protocol, but if the court wishes me to respond basically in order to the questions, I'm prepared to do that.
That sounds like an answer.
Your Honors, as to the first question, is there a transcript of the October 13th, 2006 hearing? I think that has been answered in the affirmative. There is, and I see no reason why that should not be included as part of the record. Counsel has indicated that there were other matters that were not recorded in that transcript, and I believe that is correct. And counsel has provided their recollection based upon their inquiries as to what those issues were. We do not disagree with that. We believe that those issues were discussed and rulings were made. So to the extent that they have reconstructed or provided a basis for a reconstruction of the record on those issues, we have no objection to that. As to question number 2 regarding the unrecorded bench conference before Mr. Martin's testimony, I think counsel correctly framed the status right now, and that is there is no disagreement between counsel and ourselves as to that unrecorded bench conference. There was an error regarded in the surrounding issue, but that's not the question. The question being, do we accept the statement of counsel as to the nature of that conference? Whether the district court should be ordered to clarify whether it accepts it or not, that, quite frankly, I think is a question for Your Honors to decide. I don't know how the court would necessarily clarify that, but we agree that is what happened.
And Judge Hawthorne alluded, if we read the court's order to mean, in effect, that the court did agree or did accept the agreed upon characterization, clarification would be unnecessary.
I would agree. As to the third question regarding the court's proposed comments to jurors regarding contact with court staff, and I hope you can bear with me, I was trial counsel, as was Ms. Warren. I don't recall that there ever was a set of proposed comments prepared for the court to give the jury. I know that Judge Speer made a comment beforehand that he was intending, I believe, to prepare some comments that would be given to the jurors regarding their contact with court staff. I am not aware, and quite frankly, I do not believe that any such comments were prepared. Obviously, if none were prepared, then they cannot be included as part of the record. I also have a concern that if in fact there were comments prepared that would be given to the jurors, there's no indication that I'm aware of that they ever were in fact given to the jurors. So I think if my response to that is basically that if the comments were prepared and read to the jurors, they should probably be included in the record. But if they were never prepared, or if they were prepared but never read to the jurors, then they should not be made part of the record. As Your Honors have pointed out, that it sounds to me like that is basically creating a record or evidence that didn't exist.
What about, what is your position on whether the record should reflect this, these threshold determinations about whether the comments were ever prepared, or indeed whether they were ever delivered, given to the jurors?
I have no objection to that being determined. It, as it indicated in my own recollection of the trial, is I don't think it occurred, but that is a question that Judge Speer would probably have to answer. There's a second part to that question, and that is, should the district court be ordered to reconstruct, for inclusion in the record, all unrecorded instances of juror contact with court staff? I don't believe that that can be accomplished, quite frankly, at this point in time, and I don't believe it is necessary that it should be. Counsel alluded to there being numerous contacts between jurors and court staff. That's a pretty vague statement. There were contacts every day of the trial between jurors and court staff, of necessity. The record currently, and the transcripts indicate only two instances of apparent contact that might rise to some level of concern, and counsel, I think, addressed those in their motions. One dealing with the juror who, on the first day of deliberation, indicated that she was concerned about a fellow juror who was making derogatory comments about female district attorneys and witnesses and detectives. That is fully recorded in the transcript, so I don't think anything needs to be reconstructed as to that. That entire exchange has been duly recorded. In the course of that, there was a mention that the juror who was causing the concern had previously complained about the district attorney repeating profanities that witnesses had used, and he was complaining, apparently. Why was it necessary for the district attorney to repeat those profanities? Nobody was aware of that at the time. It only came up, I think, during the discussion of the objection to by the one juror about the gentleman speaking ill of women. So those are the only two instances I'm aware of that there was any kind of contact above and beyond the necessary contact between jurors and bailiffs during the course of the trial. And I think they are recorded as well as can be recorded at this time. We are now some 4 years from the trial, and to try to reconstruct at this point any additional contacts, I think, would be an exercise in futility. Fourth question, should the district court supplement the record with the November 7th minute order regarding the removal of the exhibits? There is such a minute order. It has always been there. And to the extent that if it is not part of the record already, yes, it should be part of the record. The second part to that question was, should the district court clarify whether it held a hearing on that motion? Unlike counsel, I was present, and there was no hearing. That's my recollection, at least. There was no hearing on that motion. It was granted without a hearing. As to whether or not the court should clarify that, I'll leave that to Your Honors, but I don't take a position one way or the other. Number five, should the district court be ordered to supplement the record with a copy of the written opinion in United States versus McVeigh? I believe counsel stated correctly that initially I prepared our response, and I indicated we had no objection. I'm not an appellate lawyer. I think in retrospect, I would change my position on that. I do not think that it should be made part of the record because it was simply not part of the record. Counsel did indicate he was going, Mr. Root indicated he was going to provide a copy of the McVeigh opinion and apparently never did. My understanding of the record is to basically record what actually happened, not what might have happened or could have happened and did not. So my position is I don't believe it's appropriate to supplement the record now with that opinion.
Mr. Howard, let me ask you, I wanted to ask Ms. Johnson and I didn't get a chance to. Do you know whether or not the McVeigh case that we're talking about here was cited in defendant's motion asking the court to follow those publicity guidelines of that case? Was it cited in the motion and not attached, or was it just generally referred to without a citation and not attached?
Honest, I do not recall. The I believe that it was, I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know.
Just to on the opinion itself is that it never was attached to the motion.
I'm sorry, sir.
Your position is that it never was attached to the motion.
That's correct.
And therefore it should not be attached now.
Yes, sir. And that's, again, based on my recollection. I don't believe that it was ever attached. Question number six, should the district court be ordered to supplement the record with photographs showing the size of the trial courtroom? Such photographs were taken. It was the intent of Mr. Root to provide those to the court. Similar to the McVeigh opinion, I don't know if they ever were or were not. Obviously, if they had been provided and were lost, copies exist and they should be made part of the record. My recollection, I do not believe that they were ever provided. I think the intent was to do so. I'm speculating here to a certain extent. I think it's possible that Mr. Root looked at them and decided they didn't establish what he hoped they would establish, and he simply did not do it. And so, again, to now supplement the record with something that basically did not exist or was not provided would not be proper. Number seven, should the district court be ordered to reconstruct the security measures in place during defendant's trial? And it's our position that it should not, for several reasons. One is that it's virtually impossible, I think, at this point, to reconstruct it beyond what is already in the record. There, in the record, is a transcript of a hearing on October 17th, 2006, in which Judge Speer describes the nature of the security in the courtroom, how many deputies, how many uniformed deputies are present in the courtroom, and where they were stationed. He also indicates that jurors will be brought in through the back door of the courtroom so as to avoid the additional security measures in the hallway, in the public hallway, which included a scanning device. Counsel is correct. Mr. Root made numerous objections to security. Quite frankly, a lot of hyperbole in that. She mentioned snipers on the roof. That is what Mr. Root alleged. There was SWAT team members on the roof of the courthouse. They were not snipers. They were SWAT team members there for security. Part of the problem that people have in saying that anything should be reconstructed is even if we were to establish what security measures there were, it's not clear what the jurors ever saw of those security measures. There were, I can tell the court, as a member of the prosecution at the time, there were a lot of security measures that nobody was aware of, taken for our safety of witnesses. And I think it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to reconstruct not only what security measures there were, but what any juror would have been aware of. As to question number eight, should the defendant be granted a reasonable time in which to locate sealed documents filed or intended to be filed? Your Honor, this trial occurred from October 16th of 2006 to November the 3rd. Sentencing was February of 2007. I think people's position is there has been more than a reasonable amount of time for such to have occurred.
Your position, counsel, is those documents were not filed. They never were filed?
That's my belief, yes, sir. I think that there were, in the heat of trial, I think there were times when defense counsel made a statement, I intend to do something, I'm going to file something, and then upon reconsideration simply decided not to do it. If since 2007 those items have not been located, I think that's been a reasonable time and that there should be no additional time granted to look for what may not even exist. And
does that answer all the questions the precise questions that we asked, right?
Yes, sir.
I have a couple of general questions for you, counsel, and then I may ask Ms. Johnson to come up and address these as well. I understand that this remand order that was issued before this particular motions division was constituted caused some confusion about what was or wasn't included in the remand order. Have you dealt with these orders before, and what is your experience, and what could we do better next time?
Your Honor, I have never dealt with it before, and I would not presume to suggest any. I was confused, but I think my confusion certainly stemmed a great part from I've never been involved in such an order before, and so it wasn't, and that's why I indicated I'm reversing myself on the issue of including the McVeigh opinion. Quite frankly, my position initially would be I didn't see any harm in it, so why not? Upon further reflection, I can see that it's probably important that the record not to be, and that the record be the record of what actually occurred. So I would not be able to respond to that question, I'm afraid.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, would you come back up? And we actually have a couple of, at least I have, and my colleagues may have a few more, but I have a couple of specific questions before we get to that more general one. Just so I clarify your view on this, your view is that it is that the McVeigh opinion was at least potentially attached to that motion.
I think the fairest reading of the existing record, Your Honor, is that it was attached and somehow got lost along the way. And what I'm referring to is the record site let me have a moment. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I have it right, there it is. I had it right in front of me. The motion is motion 16A at volume 2 of the record, pages 430 to 431. And to loop back, if I may, to Judge Hawthorne's earlier question, there's no there's not even any citation. There's no F sub citation. It simply says something like, as set forth in the attached McVeigh opinion. So from that, we have an ambiguity because we don't, without supplementing the record now, there's an ambiguity in the record as to which McVeigh opinion of the many that there are. Correct, exactly, Your Honor. And
go ahead. Sorry, I don't mean, I'm just going to ask, how do we know then which McVeigh opinion was attached?
Well, through our investigation, we believe it's the one that we have cited, and I don't think the state disputes that in terms of going back to, I understand Mr. Hauer has today changed his position, but in terms of his early, I don't understand that they were factually disputing that that's the correct McVeigh opinion. And it is a McVeigh opinion that addresses media exposure and attorneys talking to the media. So, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's quite all right. We'll hear whatever you have to left to say on the McVeigh opinion.
Sure. I was simply going to say, so the motion itself reflects trial counsel's obvious intent that he believed he had attached it. That's all I want to say.
Similar then on the sealed documents, I think I may have asked you this, but your view is, were those filed or not your view is we don't know for sure.
Exactly, Your Honor. I wish I could answer some of these questions better,
but
I live with the record we have, which is why we're trying to make it better.
Finally, I have this general question, and then my colleagues may have others. The same question to you. Obviously, it's caused a little bit of confusion and triggered a fair share of attention. Is this merely because this particular case is ancillary or runs hand in hand with the capital case? Is that one of the reasons this generates so much attention? Or what is the remand?
Your Honor, I will offer a couple comments. I don't think the remand order was poorly framed, but if the court is looking for constructive suggestions for future remand orders, perhaps a direction to the trial court to hold an initial status conference on remand so that the parties can come in verbally and all just talk these issues through up front. And frankly, that was something we had requested. We filed a motion for a status conference with the district court in Mr. Ray's case at the outset of the remand proceedings because we thought that was the most sensible way to proceed. For whatever reason, the district court rejected that suggestion and wanted to simply proceed in writing. And you know, appeared the district court was eager to send this back up, frankly, as quickly as possible. And so that might be one suggestion for future remand orders.
In your view, is it necessary to even have a remand order to correct the record under 10E?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I have considered that question before, but I think, if I may, my memory of the rule is that the what 10E contemplates is that the district court is involved, and I think in order to get the district court involved, we do need a remand order. And then the last line of 10E says, all other questions as to the form and content of the record shall be presented to the appellate court. But clearly, when there are disputes among the parties, as we have a few here, the most sensible fact finder to resolve those disputes is the district court. I think in Mr. Howard's comments several times, he said, I may be speculating, but I think this, or I dispute that. You know, these are factual disputes, and really this court should not be in the position of resolving them. Judge Speer should, and that's why we've asked for some of the reconstruction hearings that we've requested.
Court thanks both counsel, all counsel, for appearing today and answering our questions. This motion will now be at issue, and an opinion will issue in due course, and an order will issue in due course.